This podcast is sponsored by AppDynamics, a leader in business and application performance monitoring. Optimize app performance, increase team velocity, and drive business with end-to-end visibility, from code level to customer experience.
Welcome to the InfoQ podcast. My name is Wes Rice, and I'm your host. I'm a software engineer who gets the amazing privilege to chair the English QCon software conferences brought to you by InfoQ. Both QCon and InfoQ are practitioner-driven and focused on offering software-centric inspiration and insights for tech leads, architects, and software leaders like you. Our aim isn't to teach, but to offer inspiration and proofs from company and engineers who have been down the technical road that you want to explore. I'm really excited to introduce our next guest today. I first met her somewhere around 2013. At that time, I had a new team. I had just convinced them that we wanted to go with Git over Subversion. I was teaching a class at the University of Louisville where I was introducing Git to somewhere around 30 to 35 students. Those two things were stressing my rudimentary knowledge of Git. So I remember seeing this talk at a conference and talking to the person afterwards. That talk was Git Happens, and the person was, of course, Jessica Kerr. Jessica Kerr is a developer at Atomist. Their LinkedIn page says they're working on reducing barriers to developing great software. She's extremely well known for blogging, speaking, podcasting around functional languages, about Git that I just mentioned, property-based testing, and a variety of other things. Some of the work she's done has been around Elm. She's done a lot of work with the JVM and languages like Scala and Clojure. In today's podcast, we're going to talk a bit about Atomist and their architecture. We're going to talk about yak shaving. Yeah, stay tuned for that one. And then we're going to talk a bit about diversity in tech. Jessica, welcome to the InfoQ podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
So the last time we talked, you were at Stripe. You've since moved over, I guess, the beginning of the year over to Atomist. What are you focused on at Atomist now?
Okay. Well, first of all, I loved working at Stripe. Stripe was awesome. But Atomist is like the most exciting place I've ever worked because my vision is very much in line with this company's vision. And that vision is about changing the way we develop software to add a whole nother level of automation. And I don't want to scare anybody by talking about like the really exciting bits, although I do in my conference talk. So at a high level, we're hoping to change the way we develop software by automating the way we write code, by actually automating code changes, not like code generation that we have now where there's like a source of truth outside of the code. No, the source of truth stays in the code, but we can automate some of that work. The second half of Atomist, which is what we're mostly focused on at the moment, is automating coordination process, because most of what we do is not, in fact, typing, of course. It is coordinating with other people and figuring out what to do next.
A lot of this is leveraging a chatbot UI, right?
Right. And most of that, we figure, happens or is moving toward happening in Slack.
Okay, sounds cool. If you had to describe the app Atomist is working on in one sentence, how would you do it?
The one sentence is, Atomist is a programmable Slack bot backed by a graph database. And we're tracking commits and builds and deployments if you're integrated with that. And instead of getting like a stream of events in Slack of, oh, so-and-so made a commit. Oh, a build started. Oh, a build finished. Oh, bunch of other stuff, whatever else happens. You get like a message about that push. Really, it's a push, the group of commits that you push to GitHub all at once. You get a cute little summary. And that summary updates when the build starts. And it updates when the build completes. So you get, instead of an event stream, you get one summary that updates, which is cool. And then there's buttons on it so that you can take action right from there. If the build fails, you can restart it.
I think that was a bit of a run-on sentence, Jessica. So what are the things you've been focused on with it?
This is going to be exciting, but I'm actually personally working on, in a few weeks anyway, parsing the build log and telling you right in Slack what the failure was. So you can see, oh, it was a linter failure. Oh, this was a temporary one and it's worth restarting kind of thing.
You're going to walk that JVM stack and be able to talk about where the errors came from?
You know, we're never going to get it for all of them.
Yeah.
But if we can get the most common ones coming out with a message so that you rarely have to click through and scroll to the bottom of the build log.
Yeah.
That would just, it reduces friction.
Sure.
And most of speeding ourselves up is not doing the same things faster. It's not having to do certain things. And the tiny little things that we don't have to do let us keep our concentration.
It's all about context switching, right? Software teams are already in Slack, so there's less of a context switch when if you can stitch all these interactions together. One of the really cool things about the Atomist Slackbot that you've been talking about is it's really the first system, at least I can really relate to, with automation of development tasks that uses a chatbot as the UI. So that's really cool. What made you all decide that this was the interface for the app that you wanted to build?
Because we don't want to give you one place that you can go to see all your information, where really it turns out to be one additional place that you have to go in addition to all those other informations. I mean, you're going to update your issues in your issue tracker most of the time. But for really simple things, maybe you don't have to. Our idea is you're already in Slack, assuming you're already in Slack. If you're not, well, maybe you will be soon. That's our theory. Anyway, you're already in Slack, and we want to bring the information correlated from a bunch of different systems, your issue trackers, your CI, and your version control, to where you already are in ways that are as useful and slick as we possibly can and correlated between the different things, and also with actions. In Slack, you can add buttons to messages that come from a bot or from the API. And then those buttons make a web call, and it turns out to be really complicated to set it up so that we can put a button that refers to a link that hits one service that knows what to do based on the other things we've already sent you. This is not technically easy, but now that we have it, we can actually write little programs that respond to commands that you type in Slack or to events that come in, like a build completed or a commit was pushed. Or PR was made. And that way, when you get a PR notification, there's a button on it that says merge, depending on what your build has done and your other, what do you call those things for, you know, statuses, those statuses on a PR.
Two questions. What's the architecture look like? How's it built? And what's the tech stack?
Okay. Our little programs, we call them rugs, are rugs that the bot reads and operates on based on events that come in or commands that you type in Slack. Those are in TypeScript. And then we actually run the TypeScript, well, compiled to JavaScript, and we run that JavaScript in Nashorn on the JVM for sandboxing. Most of our infrastructure is Scala and Clojure and Java.
What about the rest of your architecture? Things like your cloud provider, are you running on Amazon?
Oh yeah, we're on Amazon. Of course, that integrates with Slack, so we receive deployment events. We have Kubernetes, and most of our stuff is in Docker. So we use Maven to build Docker containers, push those to a Docker registry. And then we have a little bit of infrastructure on Kubernetes that as soon as a new package appears, pulls it down so that we can have buttons in Slack to say deploy after a build is complete. And then that causes a tag, which causes another build, which causes, anyway. And it magically appears in Kubernetes.
So what did you learn about building a chatbot for Slack? Any new insights?
We do have some techniques for like deliberate use of Slack.
Yeah. What's that mean?
So one thing about Slack is we haven't developed conventions and customs, we as an industry, around which channels matter. I think each company does this a little bit. So for instance, in Atomist, at the very high volume end, I've got my personal stream, which I use as a notebook. It's just a Tron stream. We also have like other people have Hoffhaus and Radio Russ and Tanya Coding. This is just what I'm in the middle of. And I can record error messages so I can find them again. And if I have a question for somebody, I will ping them and they will come into my stream. But there is no expectation that anyone else is following that. This is for my own reference, and it's very high volume.
I absolutely love that, by the way. I do a developer journal whenever I'm starting on a project, but it's my own little Google Doc that I'm typing all these things into, and I have to like explicitly share. So when I read about your Jessatron stream, that I thought that was so cool because it's like broadcasting for anybody who chooses to subscribe to the event that here is my developer journal, the things that are going on that are affecting me. I thought that was really cool.
Although I hope people aren't following it. In fact, I like had to tell my VP, Christian, do not follow the stream. I mean, I don't need you to pop in there every time I'm working. If I ping you, come look. Because he would just like answer the questions that I had posted in there that I was trying to solve, which did totally speed me up. But I don't want to be a distraction to him. On the other hand, there's channels a level up from that, like engineering, where if I have a question that I need that's a blocker, and I need an answer, And I don't know directly who to ask, or I don't know who's available. I'll post it in engineering. Also, if we have any like discussion that is going to affect design outside of my particular work, that will move to engineering. And engineering is a channel that you follow if you're there. It's not one that you need to read the archives of, but it is one that while we're working, if we have a minute, we'll pop in and see what's going on because we might be able to join in and contribute. We also have a Zoom channel for this. And then, but that has a pretty high volume and you're not expected to look at it. The next level up from that is stand-up, which since we're on three continents, we don't all get together for an in-person stand-up every day. Some of us do, but it depends on your time zone. But everybody posts in the stand-up channel what they did yesterday, what they're working on today, if they have any blockers. So that is one that when I come back after a day out of work, I will read everything in stand-up.
Oh, that's cool.
And then I'll pull out the important bits from stand-up. If anything is like changing state in the company, if we're shifting focus somehow, if a design decision has been overridden and we're not going to do it this way anymore, we're now going to do it this other way, I will put that, or other people will, in the What Happened channel, which is extremely low volume. It's not for process things. It's for things that have changed. Like our app just got approved in the Slack marketplace. So now we're an official discoverable Slack app. That goes into What Happened. That is different. When we're shifting focus from one feature development to another, we just shifted over to work carefully on getting people enrolled in receiving build events. That goes into What Happened because it's a change. So that is one that if I go on vacation for a week, I'm not going to read all of stand-up, but I absolutely will read What Happened. So when you have these like different levels of context, then you know what you actually need to follow and what you can safely ignore. And I push shift escape a lot.
Clear all the unreads. I know it well.
Clear all the unreads.
One of the other things that I wanted to talk about, and I mentioned it kind of in the introduction, it was this idea of yak shaving. You wrote a series of blog posts that talk about yak shaving. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Okay, so yak shaving is an expression, and I really like this expression. And it means everything that you're doing in order to get to the thing you actually wanted to do. So it doesn't matter really what the expression is, as long as it makes you say, why would you do that? Because in our industry is stuff like, well, I want to make this change, but in order to do that, I need to set up my environment. And how much effort do you do setting up your environment? And then you're like, oh, there's not a test for it, so I should write a test. And then you're like, oh, well, it would be easier to write this test if I abstracted this thing from this other test. And so then you start abstracting that. Well, in the process of that, of course, you break the other test. And then you're like, how did this ever work? This doesn't even make sense. And so now you're tracking down the developer who wrote that test that you didn't actually care about.
By that time, you've completely forgot what you started with, right?
Yes. But maybe you've hit upon something even more important than what you were originally doing.
And that actually is what I really like about the blog post that you sent me. We used to call this chasing rabbits on my team. How many rabbits are you chasing? But what you've done is took it to a different level in that you've categorized, you've segmented the different types of rabbits or yaks that you're shaving in this kind. Could you tell us a bit about this idea of the black, imperial, trim, royal, and golden yaks?
Sure. So the naming is just straight out of yakbreeder.com. I had five categories of these yak shaving tasks, and they had five breeds of yaks, and they line up perfectly.
So if you've learned nothing else, you've now learned about yakbreeder.com.
Yakbreeder.com. Oh, God. It's one of those beautiful sites. It's like 5 years old, and it's so hideous. It's gorgeous. I love it.
That's awesome.
Right. So there's a lot of tasks that we do that are not directly in line with what we want to get done, but relate to it in some ways. And if we categorize them a bit, we can start to hypothesize about when it's appropriate to do them and when we're getting distracted for our own entertainment. So the black yak is like the stuff you absolutely have to get past. It's like the build is broken.
Yeah. Okay.
Or I can't even run this, or something's wrong with deployment. And those you really have to do. However, we can observe how often they happen and then start taking conscious action separately to minimize how often this happens. What are the reasons the build fails, and can we prevent that? If the build constantly fails because of linting problems, can we automate the running of the linter with autofix?
You mentioned in your blog post of then putting those into Slack so then you can then go back and actually see how many times that happened or actually inspect the number of, I guess, yaks that occurred so you know what what you should invest in time fixing.
Right. So here I'm using Slack as a way to do a kind of qualitative research in the end. If I can get my team to all report a particular problem with like a certain emoji or something, then I can go back and count those when it's time for the retro, when it's time to decide how are we going to improve our own development process and become a faster development team.
Figure out what makes sense to invest your time in automating.
Yes, yes. And we think of science as only the scientific method. And yet human systems are, when we only have one team, right? And we want to ask what would help this team. We can't do a controlled experiment. We can do an experiment where we say, let's try this for a couple weeks and then see what happens. But it's not a controlled experiment. So you kind of have to loosen up a bit. And I've found this this research technique called grounded theory, and it's from sociology. And instead of starting with the hypothesis, let's start with the question. And then let's ask people, and then let's look for trends and patterns in the answer we get. So one thing I find interesting about Slack and remote work and generally conversations that are recorded is they're searchable, and we could look for patterns in the problems that we have and the questions that we ask.
Yeah, that makes sense. Makes total sense.
Right. So these yaks, you know, don't solve them right away, but start accumulating data of some sort. And then, because it can be quite a big process to re-automate your build process or whatever it takes.
It's just like logging, right? You may not know what you're looking for, but if you at least start capturing those logs, you can eventually start to uncover some patterns or trends with it.
Exactly. Can we log our own experience?
You had a quote in here that said, sometimes the team is like, this is a mess, please change it. But other times, you're not so much shaving a yak as combing the hair in a different direction. What do you mean by that?
Right. So now we're talking about trim yaks, which are like where you try to make your code prettier, or you make an abstraction. And these things are going to help you in general in many tasks. But refactoring is one of them. And the weird thing about refactoring is that it's dangerous, and it's also more powerful than you realize. So the power in refactoring is that if you weren't familiar with the code before, after refactoring it, you know it intimately. It is part of you. It exists in your head. And that gives us power as developers, because it is my rather strong belief that the biggest factor in how quickly we can work and how reliably, in the sense that we're not likely to break anything, the biggest factor in that is how well we know the system we're changing. And that means being familiar with the code.
Right. Your mental model.
Yes, exactly. So refactoring gives you a mental model of the code that you didn't have before. However, it breaks the mental model of everyone else on the team.
Yeah, absolutely.
If they were familiar with the old code, they no longer are. So that's dangerous. So you've got to consult with the rest of the team. Sometimes I'll refactor code and then throw it away, because once I've refactored it, I understand it in its old form too. Other times the team is like, oh, please, please fix that. And then the mental model is so rough already because it's messy that the refactoring is an improvement for everybody.
This next one I dig a lot, and it's the royal yak. And in this part, you mentioned psychological safety quite a bit. So what are the royal yaks?
The royal yaks are talking to people.
Yeah.
We feel like if we're just chatting, we're wasting time. But I disagree. We're forming bonds with another person. Part of the mental model that we need as developers, it's not just the code. We also need a mental model of everyone on our team. We need to know what they know, so we can ask them, and so that we can trust them to make decisions that would correlate with our decisions, because we have the same values and objectives, and we have the same information. We also need to know what they don't know so that we can tell them when they need to know it, so that we can keep the rest of our team's mental models up to date. So we have to have a mental model of everyone else's mental model, which is hard, and of our relationships with each other. So all that chit-chat, that bonding, it opens the communication lines, and it helps us get to know each other and our different priorities and our different skills, and that's super important. And then other times we're like directly talking about the code and sharing our mental model, which I think is possibly the biggest benefit of pairing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that you know you're having a shared mental model because you're both right there in the code. And it's the only way I know to transfer a mental model. Diagrams do not do it. They help if you draw them together. Venn diagrams kind of help, but they're totally useless if they're stale, if they're already been produced. But working in the code together does transfer mental model. And that's how you can bring productivity to the rest of your team if you're the most productive person.
Yeah. Plus it helps you understand who can help you get something done, who can help you learn something new in the code base or whatever you may need to do. Absolutely. There was a blog post you made and it was called Hyperproductive Development. And it was a bit of a counter argument that I might have expected. And it was talking about the negative effects of a 10X developer. And as I was reading about this Royal Yak and the psychological safety of teamwork, that blog post kind of jumped out as I was kind of doing this research. Could you talk a bit about how being a 10X developer or someone on the team could actually undermine productivity of a team?
Yes. So for me, that blog post was actually about writing about the positives of 10X developer, because for years I've been like, 10X developer, not really a thing. The only way to be a 10X developer is to hold your team back, right? Because I've worked with some of those, the ones that nobody else is allowed in the meetings with the customers. And every commit, literally every commit, has to be merged by them and meet their approval and their 2002 Java standards. Okay. People I would not work with again. So this blog post was about, when is a 10X developer great? And I think it goes back to the number one factor in developer productivity being understanding the existing system. And the systems we understand the best are the ones we personally wrote. And those exist both in the computer and in our heads. So when we want to change them, it's like a flowing out and we already know what they do. We know everything they'll impact. And that is by far the most productive way to develop. That really is 10 times more productive than trying to work on a system that you didn't write, that a bunch of other people are changing at the same time, that you can't even keep track of what all is going on. And every time you need to make a change, you've got to first figure out that entire subsystem that you're about to change. Easily 10 times more productive when you've already got it in your head, probably 100. Well, compared to being completely unfamiliar with it. That can be great. And especially when you have an early phase company, you need those people and you need that to be fast. But when you want to make something bigger than one person can maintain, or when you want to be safer than, oh crap, this one person is gone, we're doomed, then you have to spread that knowledge and you're going to pay a cost. You're not going to get the same per developer productivity, because even if two people have been pairing, and they both understand the system, as soon as you ask them or let them do things separately, then they're changing it out from under each other. And there's always going to be catch up and there's going to be miscommunications. And then it's like, oh, shoot, I didn't know that that was changed. So now that I broke something, you get that friction as soon as you introduce anyone else.
Yeah, but even then, like you mentioned, I think in this post too, talking about that New York Times article that Matt Sataguchi was mentioned in about building effective teams at Google. It basically was talking about how the team itself as a unit can work better than any individual on a team could, right?
Right. So when you have a system that's bigger than one person can maintain, then you've got to move to a team. And then you have to have a lot of people who understand overlapping portions of the system and overlapping concerns of the system and overlapping constraints. When we can't, as one person, understand the whole thing, which these days we mostly can't because our software systems are way bigger than that.
Huge. Yeah.
You've got to spread it out. And then what you need to do is reduce all that friction between people. And this gets back to the Royal Yaks of talking to people. And one of the purposes of that is to achieve psychological safety, which is defined as people feel safe saying what they really think, that their ideas are going to be appreciated and their concerns are going to be welcomed and not shut down. When people make a mistake, they're like, yo, check out this thing. I totally screwed up. And then you can talk about, oh, wow, I can see how that would happen because this piece of information that you needed was like way over there. How can we make it so that next time we have to make a similar decision, the information that we need is right in front of us? Then you can grow as a team and you can become faster and faster.
Any strategies, tips, techniques on how you can build psychological safety on your teams?
Oh, gosh. I think there are whole people who make their jobs out of that. And like really study how to do that. I am not one of them. personally, I try to thank anyone who points out something that's wrong. Oh, I avoid the words simple and trivial. I don't assume that something that's easy for me is easy for other people. Because when you do know more about a particular system than someone else, it's really easy to make them feel stupid.
Sure it is. Yeah. One I heard someone tell me the other day that I thought was really good was assume good intent.
Yeah.
It's real hard in these short little messages that we send back and forth to hear that and just assume it's negative.
That's so true. Yeah. Interacting with them as a person helps you see them as a person, helps you assume good intent, which smooths out a lot of friction in coordinating development. Just the other day at Atomist, we were talking in our retrospective about how can we avoid these prickly bits in Slack? Because that little bite-sized communication can look really prickly, especially when you come back to it later and just see a snippet of it. And two things that we came to, one was assume good intentions, and the other one was fall back quickly to Zoom.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Face-to-face. I like that.
Right. If you have any, like, even just feelings of, ow, I don't like how you said that. What do you actually mean there? Go to Zoom. I like to think of it like home birth is safe because there's a hospital nearby. And if you have like a midwife there who knows when it's time to go to the hospital, then it's as safe or more safe than hospital birth. So Slack is safe because we have Zoom.
We know it's there. Yep. Makes sense. All right. So last yak, one yak to go, and that is the golden yak. What is this mythical beast of the golden yak?
Golden yak is my favorite yak. Because there are some frictions that when we solve them, it winds up changing the way we work entirely and opening up whole new ways of working. I'm hoping that Slack will be one of those, actually. So one thing I like about remote work is that you can't just assume communication magically happens because you're in the same office. You have to be deliberate about it. How will we find out what's important? People are going to tell us with their words. So communication winds up often being searchable in Slack, or we'll record Zoom meetings sometimes, although really, does anybody ever watch those? I hope not. Yeah, so we have to think about our communication. And I think that then when we get that like searchable context in Slack and stuff, we get whole new benefits out of that we didn't expect it. I think just being deliberate about our communication is going to be a huge benefit.
Sure.
But easier examples are like Git. You talked about Git earlier. Git is totally a golden yak.
Yeah, of course. CI/CD is a golden yak.
Yes, yes. Continuous integration is something that, oh, we wish our tests worked regularly. And then once you get your tests worked regularly, suddenly your pace of development drastically increases because in addition to removing pain, you've removed fear.
Sure, yeah.
Git is the same way.
Absolutely.
Because you have like local changes and branches and you can always roll back. One time when we were on Subversion.
That sounds like a bad joke. This one time when we're on Subversion.
It's not as scary as. So I was in the middle of a rebase.
There you have it. Jessica Kerr's five yaks. We've got the black yak, aka the attack yak. You must defeat them to proceed. Imperial yaks, the yak stack. One obstacle leads to another. Trim yaks or hacking yaks, things that increase your speed at many, many tasks. Royal yaks, the relationship yaks, the talking to people. And then, of course, the rarest of all, the golden yaks, the ones that you shave them well enough and they'll change the way we work. Okay, I want to shift gears one more time, but there was a blog post that you wrote called Diversity is Not the Magic Pill. It was triggered from an issue of the Journal of Organizational Psychology that you were reading. Can you tell me a bit about that blog post and what you were going for in it?
Sure. So I was reading an article, it's actually about executive teams, which executive teams, like developers, are system builders and system movers. And there are some studies that we hear about, that I personally hear about pretty often, that say that diverse teams are more productive, diverse teams are more powerful. This article broke it down and said, under some circumstances, diverse teams are more powerful. Here is a... what did it call it? Oh, there's mediating factors, and then these are technical terms. Diverse teams are more important under certain circumstances, and one of those circumstances is innovation team culture. And I was like, what the heck is that? And eventually, like halfway through the article, I found a definition, and it was whether people think that their ideas about how to improve the team's work will be appreciated and implemented, sometimes implemented. And if you don't have that, if your team doesn't want new ideas, then you don't want diversity. Diversity winds up resulting in categorization, in-group, out-group, decreases communication. But if you have that innovation team culture, then team communication goes up, and having those extra ideas and also a more well-defined sense of identity, like if we're all very different except that we have this same common goal, then your commonality is built around that common goal, not around the sports team that you all cheer for. That was my opinion. That was not in the article. But the article did say that it found a positive effect of diversity only in very high innovation team culture. The interesting part about that is, diversity or not, I want a high innovation team culture, because that is what is going to make my team get more and more productive over time. So if you just want me to follow the rules, forget it. I don't want to be on your team, diverse or not. It's not going to be diverse for long.
Right. Absolutely.
So if we just aim for that, then we're helping with diversity and we're helping ourselves now.
So what did you learn? How do you create a culture that's driven or focused around innovation? How do you create innovative culture?
Yes, you ask. Are like new ideas from the people on the team welcomed? I mean, if they've run out of new ideas, then that's his own problem. But so I think Agile in a lot of ways is about building innovation culture. Take the retrospective. The retrospective is a formal place where you are asked for your ideas for how to improve. What could we work on? How could we work on that? There's a very specific defined space. It's a safe space. Ideas are all appreciated. They're not all implemented, but some of them are. I mean, in my opinion, the retrospective was the core practice of Agile, because it's about constant improvement. It's about reflection and improvement. Now, once you get that innovation culture, you don't necessarily need a formal retrospective, because it's happening every day. But that's a way to get started with appreciating ideas. And the other thing is, like, watch your language. When someone offers an idea that you don't agree with, how do you respond? Do you say, no, that's stupid? Or do you say, wow, that's an interesting idea. Why do you think that would help? Or how do you think that would help? Do you say, well, with pairing, it's when someone has a different idea of how to do stuff and you're like, that is never going to work. Well, try it. Give it 15 minutes. What's it going to cost you? Worst case, you're proven right. Best case, you learn something entirely new.
Sure, makes sense. All right, Jessica, I feel like we've come full circle after chatting all those years ago about Git. We've covered a crazy lot on this podcast, from Atomist architecture to yak shaving, and even touched a bit on diversity. Thank you for taking the time to chat with us.
Thank you, Wesley.